I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's been 4 years since Vermont passed a law allowing terminally ill patients to use physician-prescribed medication to die. The conversation and testimony around that legislation was emotional on both sides, and the final bill to allow it came with both relief and condemnation. In the years since, 52 people have received a prescription for the medication, and 29 people are known to have used it. Each of them, of course, has a story. Today on the program, we're going to look at the law, talk with some of the people whose loved ones have used it, and others who are opposed or conflicted. Joining us first today from VPR's Montpelier studio is Rob Merman. Rob is a Vermont entertainer, author, and performer. In 2015, he helped his longtime friend use Vermont's Act 39 to hasten his own death. Rob, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane.
So your friend was named Bill Morancy. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Bill was a projectionist at the Savoy Theater here in Montpelier, and he was a film critic.
And he was your friend?
We were neighbors in adjoining apartments here downtown Montpelier. We knew each other for about 10 years.
So when it came time for Bill to start thinking about what he was going to do, why was he looking at Act 39 and looking at getting a prescription to hasten his death?
Well, Bill was 70 years old, very healthy. He said he had never in his life spent a night in a hospital. And one day we were playing tennis, and he was fine. But the next day he woke up with some pains in his chest. We thought maybe it was a mild heart attack. We took him to the hospital, and when the x-rays came back, the doctor said, Bill, you have massive pancreatic cancer that has spread throughout your body. And they gave Bill a prognosis of 6 months to live.
That must have been difficult, you know, for everybody, certainly for Bill and certainly for those of you who cared about him. He decided that he wanted to use this law that allowed him to get medication from a doctor. And, Rob, you were involved in assisting him and in being a friend through this process and, in fact, in being there when he died. Could you talk a little bit about what his thoughts were in deciding whether or not to use this medication?
Well, when he got the diagnosis, he knew right away what it meant. He said to the doctor straight away, he said, I know what this is. This is a death sentence. And as it turned out, he didn't have 6 months. He had 3 months. And he asked me to be his proxy in helping him with Act 39. Both Bill and I did not know anything about what Act 39 really was until the doctors explained. Bill had asked, what are my options? And they went through all the different options for palliative care and hospice care. And finally, at the end, they mentioned Act 39, and we found out more information about that. And Bill's immediate thought, which he held very strongly for his last 3 months, was that he didn't want to become so diminished, not just physically but mentally, that he couldn't carry on a deep, good conversation with friends. That was one of the most important things in his life, he said. He didn't want to get so foggy in his mind that he couldn't communicate with the world.
Rob, one of the requirements of Act 39 is that the patient, him or herself, must be able to self-administer the medication. But you were there to help Bill when Bill decided to use the medicine. Most people don't have cause to witness that or to experience it. Can you describe a little bit what actually happens when Bill used that medication?
Yes, we followed the protocols described by the doctors about Act 39. And it wasn't easy, of course, for Bill or for myself. I would say that utilizing Act 39 is not for everybody, for sure. But for Bill, he was determined to die in the way he lived, which was on his own terms, still conscious of himself and the world around him. The protocols involved taking 100 tablets. They were capsules, actually, sleeping capsules. And we had to open each capsule and pour the powder into a glass. This took quite a while. First, an hour before he would take what we called the drink, he was supposed to take two pills. One was an anti-nausea pill and one was an anti-anxiety pill. So an hour before he decided it was time, I said to Bill, here's the anti-anxiety pill. He said, I don't need that. So I said, okay, well, here's the anti-nausea pill so you wouldn't bring up the drink after you've taken it. He took that, and then we had an hour to empty the capsules and tell each other last stories. And that was obviously a very profound hour. And then when it was time to take the drink, Bill sat up in the couch. He didn't want to lie down in the bed. And he got comfortable, and we both – I said, Bill, you're not going to drink alone. I'll drink with you. And he looked at me for a second and in surprise, and I said, where's your whiskey? So I took his whiskey, and he had his drink. I didn't know what to expect. The doctor said that it would work very quickly, and that's what happened. When it finally came time for him to take the drink, he drank it right down. He put his head back on the couch. His legs were crossed, just like he was relaxing, taking a nap. And within a minute, I heard one snore. So I knew, okay, he'd fallen asleep. That was the first step. And about 30 seconds after that, his breathing started to get slower. And so I figured he slipped into a coma, which is what the doctor said would happen. And then in another minute, his breathing finally stopped. It was very gentle. It all happened within 2 minutes. It was profound. It was astonishing, emotional for me, and also mixed with a sense of relief that it went so smoothly. It was like a whisper.
Rob, has your experience with your friend Bill affected how you think about your choices at the end of your life? You know, obviously nobody knows exactly how that's going to happen, but have you reflected on that in the context of Act 39?
Yeah, for sure. Bill and I, for those 3 months, we discussed the idea of dying and what it means for different people. I've experienced my parents, my sister, and other friends who have died with difficult deaths in a hospital, prolonged suffering, not just physically. That was not the important thing for my parents and my sister. It was their mental despair. They were ready to die, but the bodies just didn't give up for a while. So as far as myself, I was not an advocate for Act 39, especially before my experience with Bill, but now I am for myself. As I said, it wouldn't be for anybody or everybody, but I would consider it if I was in the same circumstances as Bill.
Well, Rob Merman, I really appreciate you telling us a little bit about Bill and your experience with him and sharing that perspective with us today. Thank you.
It's nice to be here again, Jane. Thank you very much.
That's Rob Merman. Many of you know him well as an entertainer, author, and performer. And he was telling us about his friend Bill Moranci and Bill's use of Act 39 and medical assistance in dying. And we're talking about that, Bill, today. We're talking about the 4 years since it was passed. And we're talking a little bit about some of the Vermonters who have chosen to use it. We're also going to hear concerns, issues with the bill, problems that people have, and questions. Oliver in Westminster wrote about the experience of his partner. He says 3 years ago, Maggie Lake became the third person in Vermont to use Act 39 to take a combination of drugs prescribed by her physician that would end her life. Act 39 is not perfect. There are far few doctors far too few doctors willing to prescribe the drugs and too few pharmacies that stock those drugs. But Oliver says, I'm sharing her story in the hopes that people will come to understand that this is not enabling assisted suicide, but rather giving people who are facing death a choice in how their lives can end, not suffering unremitting pain, but peacefully with dignity. Betsy Walkerman is a lawyer and president of Patient Choices Vermont, based in Shelburne. The organization was founded by her parents as an advocacy group for the passage of the patient choice at the end of life law. They worked for more than a decade on passing Act 39, and the group is now dedicated to protecting Vermont's patient choice law and educating the public and the medical community. Betsy, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Also joining us is Ed Paquin, who works to protect Vermonters with disabilities against abuse, neglect, and the violation of their rights. And he was president of the Vermont Coalition for Disability Rights and joins us today in our Montpelier studio. Ed, it's nice to have you back on the program as well.
Thank you very much.
So, Betsy, you were an advocate for the passage of this law and continue to be an advocate for education surrounding this law. Why was it so important to you and to your family to have this right and to have it connected to a physician's prescription?
Well, the activity of my family to launch the advocacy campaign that resulted in Act 39 goes back a very long ways. I mean, I remember as a teenager watching my father pound the counter on the phone with my grandfather, who was looking for a way to die peacefully after a long struggle, and that just continued to go on. And it was something very frustrating for my father, and it was a topic of family conversation for quite a long time. So when Oregon passed the bill in 1997, I believe it was, my parents took notice of that, and when they had the opportunity to start working on this here in Vermont, it became a priority really for our whole family. The work of our organization attracted the attention of thousands of people across Vermont. And I can get into the history, but whatever you'd like.
And we have some time to think about, you know, some of the ways that this has worked and not worked and the advocacy on both sides. And to that end, Ed, I want to ask you about your perspective, because this is something that as the bill was being debated, and it was debated for a couple of years in Montpelier before the original bill was passed. And this is something that you have had major concerns about. Why?
Well, I guess the first thing I want to say is that and I think Bob's shared a very compelling story, and I think his friend was an extremely lucky human being to have him as a friend. And I don't want to impugn the motives or the passions of the people who are supporting this. Where I go in my thinking on this, and my thinking has evolved over time. A generation ago, and I'm old enough to talk in terms of generations, I think I would have supported this legislation. My view has changed over time when I saw evolution in how the bill was – or the idea was presented. First, it seemed like it was all about pain. And then as pain management, I think, evolved, then it became an issue of dignity. And there is where over time and living with my own disability, I see this as a question of what is good policy for the society. And I don't want to – and I think what we have here is something that is – opens an option for a very small number of people who we hope are well connected with responsible practitioners. We hope that they're very, very thoughtful about what they're going into. We hope that they have compassionate people around them like Bob. But what we're not really addressing is those people, how does their concern or how does our concern for their passage relate to how a policy like this affects the society as a whole? And when I hear terms like death with dignity and look at a bill that takes away the liability from a physician for making a lethal prescription, I tend to be looking at what are the bigger pictures? What is the message that it gives about people with disabilities? What is the message that it gives about living with limitations, which is disability? Remember, anybody who uses this is a person with a disability, by definition, really.
Anybody who uses this also has a diagnosis of an estimated 6 months or less to live. Not a long-term impairment that people live with, but at least two physicians have to say that this patient is expected to die within the next 6 months. That doesn't make a difference for you?
I think it would be an even worse policy if there wasn't some, at least a requirement that people be looked at with physicians. For example, I suppose it's a better scenario than if we relaxed laws such that individuals could assist individuals with a suicide without having any kind of oversight. I suppose if that's what you may be comparing it to.
Well, thinking about your comments on, you know, these are people living with disabilities, and is it somehow suggesting to people with a disability that that life isn't worth living? Betsy, let me ask you to jump in here too, because you have advocated for this bill, and what about Ed's concerns?
I think the first thing I'd like to do, Jane, is just outline what the bill requires, if that's okay. I think that's important background information for all of the listeners. Act 39 is available to mentally competent adults who are Vermont residents. And in order to take advantage of medical aid in dying, they must have a terminal condition diagnosed by two doctors, meaning having 6 months or less to live. And that enables them to get terminal medication to be self-administered if and when the patient chooses. And there are many points of choice along the way. There's a process that they have to go through that includes two oral requests and one written request and confirmation by the second doctor, as well as confirmation that process has been fulfilled by the doctor by filing the appropriate forms with the Department of Health. So when we talk about, you know, questions of what people might call oversight or concerns about the process, I just want people to know that this is the process that is specified. I do appreciate the question because I'm hearing that the whole topic can be a sensitive issue for people who work hard to adapt and live productively with disabilities, and I have a lot of sympathy for that. At the same time, I'd like to draw the difference here. People who are considering medical aid in dying are very close to the end of life, as you mentioned, and they really don't have a choice to continue living. It's not about adapting to a new situation. It's about having a choice to live their last weeks or months in the way that is most vital for them and for each person. So this is about each person having a choice to make. And so in that sense, it's hastening a death that's going to happen very soon anyway. And I'd like, if I can, to speak to what that was for my dad. So my father used medical aid in dying a couple of years ago, and he told me that in his last week, he had some of the most meaningful conversations of his life. And that's just a very important thing for our family.
And do you think if he had had those conversations and then had continued living until his disease progressed at a natural rate, it would have been different for him?
He wouldn't have had those conversations. Those conversations happen because people know that. People speak differently to someone they know is leaving very, very soon. And so that's what was so different about the conversations.
Linda says, Monique Van Den was a very spiritual and physically active writer, artist, and much more. She lived with cancer for roughly 20 years, going through radiation, chemo, and several operations. The last operation took her eye along with part of her face, giving her more opportunities to learn about connecting with people in a new way. Linda also shared some journal entries, by the way, that she wrote with Monique in her final months, and you can read them at vpr.net. And Linda says, in Vermont, we are blessed to have the option of a death with dignity law, which Monique fought for and utilized when there was only pain and no quality of life. She was an amazing woman who lived 100% until she died on January 27th, 2017, at age 56. Kathleen in Graniteville, though, says, I still have many questions about Act 39. Before it was passed into law, I listened intently during the many discussions and presentations. I also did a lot of research on my own. My position then and now is the same. I do not support the killing of another person by prescribed lethal drugs, and I do not support the legislators changing the role of physicians to make them participate in legally sanctioned suicide. Kathleen thinks there are no oversights to prevent medical abuse or to prevent elder abuse. There's no accountability for the lethal doses once they've been filled. I find this totally unacceptable, she says. Well, we will get a physician's perspective coming up. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Betsy Walkerman and Ed Paquin. Betsy's a longtime advocate for the ability of people to hasten their own death with doctor-prescribed medication. Ed opposed the law, which passed 4 years ago as Act 39. We're looking at what's happening with this law, what has happened in the intervening years, and hearing some stories. Let's go to Janet, who's calling in from Randolph Center. Hi, Janet. Go right ahead.
I very much am in favor of Act 39, and I'm so proud of Vermont for pulling that off. I want to throw in an additional idea. I have a very, very close friend in New Jersey who was suffering from primary progressive aphasia, which means she cannot really talk anymore, she cannot read anymore, she can't sing, which was her biggest passion. Typing an email was more and more difficult, and it was going to get worse, and she wanted to end her life, but New Jersey doesn't have it. And in addition to that, here you have to have
You have to be within 6 months, physicians estimate will be 6 months.
And so as a result, she chose her four closest friends, and we all went with her to Switzerland to an organization called Dignitas, which is all totally, you know, monitored by physicians and so forth. But it would have been so much better if she could just stay home where she's familiar with her own familiar surroundings and her own people. But so I don't know if we would ever stretch it that far, but that was my thought.
Janet, thanks for sharing your friend's experience and your experience with that. We got a similar note from Anne who says, I suspect many people with a debilitating chronic illness, such as MS, Parkinson's, severe stroke, or others would like to take advantage of patient choice, but don't fall into that 6 months or less category. There is little assistance from the healthcare system in finding ways to continue to live a life that may have diminished to the point where living is more of a burden for both the patient and the caregivers than dying. Sometimes a person is just too weary to continue, but there's no compassionate means to relieve their situation. I wish we could find a solution to this dilemma. And for another perspective here, let's go to Lynn, who's calling in from Winooski. Hi, Lynn. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to speak to something that Betsy talked about, you know, the oral requests and all the protections in the bill. I've represented the disability community at the State House. I'm a former lobbyist. I'm a former legislator. And I've always had concerns about this bill. And I'm not sure that listeners are aware of the actual definitions in the law don't make it mandatory for the oral request, because in the definition section, the definition of capable reads that a patient has the ability to make and communicate health care decisions to a physician, including communication through persons familiar with a patient's manner of communicating, if those persons are available. So, you know, in the disability community, we look at that and say, okay, if the person cannot speak for themselves, this portion of the law allows someone to speak on their behalf. And this is one of the very many troubling aspects of the law, when that law, that definition, combined with sort of a societal view of disability and diminished capacity, you know, physically, we feel leads to potential abuse. It's one of the many sections of the law, but I think a lot of people aren't aware of that particular definition and how that could be played out in a less than proper way.
Well, Lynn, I appreciate your thoughts and your perspective on that. Ed Paquin, I'd like to come back to you here and get your thoughts on that and what you've been hearing from people sharing different perspectives.
Well, I think when I hear some of the perspectives that have been spoken this afternoon, it very much you are hearing the individual story. We're not really looking at the societal message. We're not really looking at the question of why is it that at this juncture in the progress of human beings, we do find that people don't get the support that they need in the last times. And why is it that these conversations that should be happening, regardless of whether there's a this kind of law or not, why is it that those are not happening? Why is it that people aren't supported to access whatever society can offer for pain management, any other numbers of kinds of supports that I think can be developed, are developing? You know, I'm certainly old enough to have been around the many loved ones who have passed, and the support that can be given by the community is where I think our energy should be going, rather than in something that sends a message not intended by any stretch of the imagination. Obviously, this is from a legal point of view, it's geared towards people who have been diagnosed with a terminal illness. But to other people looking in on this, the idea of suicide becomes, well, this is maybe a valid response to the pain they live in their life. It's I don't know what message it gives to young people. Vermont has a real problem with suicide. And if a person is diagnosed with a mental illness and is suicidal under Vermont law, that's grounds for taking their liberty. I know the message is obviously it's not intentional, and obviously these are good people hoping to alleviate suffering, whether the suffering is, is physical pain or emotional pain or apparently from, I guess, what the Oregon surveys have done, the idea of not wanting to be a burden on your family and other people. And that could be a noble sentiment, and that could also be a sentiment that may be manipulated. I don't know. I'm absolutely don't know.
But those are
Bob's
your
one of the first people I've ever had a chance to be in the same room with, and I have no disrespect for this man for doing what he did with his friend.
Ed's talking, Betsy, not just about the limited parameters of the law, but the larger consequences of having a law like this. Is that something that worries you?
Actually, I see that operating in the opposite way. The way that I see it is that because people have the choice to request medical aid in dying, and let me just pause here. I think it's very clear that what we're talking about is medical aid in dying, not suicide. Suicide is a word that I would attach to a situation where a person has a choice to continue living. And that is not the situation of the patients we're talking about.
Although the patients do have, they are making a decision about when to die in that case.
Exactly, exactly.
And they are taking their own lives.
That's correct.
And we should I should just pause also to say that I know that the language around this issue is very charged. And so we're trying to use neutral language. I'm trying to use neutral language. But people well know that in many cases, especially as this was being debated, it was variously described as physician-assisted suicide or as, the right to die. And there are many ways that this is discussed. But go right ahead, Betsy.
Yes. Yeah, so we do not refer to it as physician-assisted suicide because it is a self-administered medication. And yes, there are nuances around that. So I think that because the patients now have more power in the sense that they have another choice, it opens conversations with their doctors and families, or can, if a patient chooses to, open those conversations in a different way than they would have been open before. And I know this because in various sessions that we've had with community members and doctors, we receive information that doctors tell us, well, we've never really had these kinds of conversations with patients before, and doctors have been requesting more more training on, well, how do you talk to a patient about end of life and about the kind of care that they want? Yes, sometimes a patient opening this conversation might express an interest in medical aid in dying, when really there are some other support systems that might be really helpful in their situation. So I think that actually having more choice on the table actually advances the mission from a larger policy point of view of patients being served with a broader array of possible services.
To that, and Mary in Richmond says, I have friends who tell me their family members have taken advantage of this legislation and we're very happy that it was in place, but I have concerns that other options for end-of-life care would be ignored with this in place, like improvements in access to hospice and palliative care. Let's go now to one other voice here, Bob Tortolani. Dr. Tortolani is a recently retired family physician based in Brattleboro. He's also a member and former president of the Vermont Medical Society. Dr. Tortolani, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, and thank you for having this program.
So, you know, there have been this law has been in place for 4 years, and the Vermont Medical Society recently changed its official stance, which was in opposition to this bill. Why?
Well, in 2003, the stance of the Medical Society, 74% of the members actually voted that there be no laws concerning physician-assisted suicide or aid in dying. We wanted to not have any laws at all. That was our stance, and then things changed in 2017. Do you want me to go further with recent changes?
Well, just why the change? Why rescind an official opposition to it?
Well, it was an opposition to the legal system not being involved. That was the stance. We wanted this to be a physician-patient issue and not to have laws regarding it. That was our stance up until now.
If there was no law regarding it, wouldn't that leave physicians open to a number of legal issues if they were to help their patients in a way that was
physicians have not generally felt that way, that was a concern.
So what is your personal perspective on this as a physician, as somebody who has, you know, has been charged with helping people and keeping people healthy and then also, well, being there for death?
I think I can best present my situation because I had a patient who came to me about 2.5 to 3 years ago, a woman in her 60s who had non-operable brain cancer, and she has given me the right to talk about this today. She came to me with her son and asked if I would be willing, in light of the law that had been in place for about a year, to give her a prescription if she went through all the rules that she had to go through. And I said that I would be able to help her, but I would not be able to write the prescription because it was not something that I could comfortably do. It was something that ethically I did not feel comfortable with. But I was able to help her with the consultation of another physician, giving her the prognosis of 6 months, and took her written and oral evidence, and time passed, and we continued to see each other over two months or so, or 3 months. And then I referred her to a colleague who was willing to write that prescription, and she was able to get the prescription and still has it, actually.
In other words, you know, this wasn't something you felt you could do, but you did refer to her to a physician who
That's correct.
Could.
And I gave her support. I listened to her, and I helped her through the rules of the and the paperwork, and made a referral to a physician who established a new relationship and was able to comfortably give her that prescription.
Dr. Tortolani, we have a note from Guy Page, the advocacy director of the Vermont Alliance for Ethical Healthcare, and he writes, is it true that only a few doctors and pharmacies are writing and filling prescriptions?
I do not have the evidence of that. I don't think it's just a few. I think I don't have any figures on that.
We've also been hearing from some listeners that it's difficult to fill a prescription, that there are a few pharmacies that will fill it. Is that something you're also hearing from members of the medical
society? I'm not hearing that.
Is that something that you're hearing, Betsy?
Actually, yes. So I would say there are quite a few doctors who have prescribed, especially around Chittenden County. It's a little more difficult in the southern and eastern part of the state. There is right now, to my knowledge, one pharmacy. It has to be a compounding pharmacy. So there are special requirements, and so that is something that, people have to deal with. There's one pharmacy that's located in Middlebury.
Well, it's very interesting to hear the, multiple perspectives on this and all of the, concerns, all of the non-concerns that people have about this, because certainly 4 years on, we're looking at a very small population of Vermonters who have utilized this law, but interesting to hear about the many many ways that it's considered. I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Bob Tortolani, a member and former president of the Vermont Medical Society. Betsy Wackerman is a lawyer and president of Patient Choices Vermont, an advocacy group for medically assisted death and end-of-life choices. We'll put a link to her organization at vpr.net. And Ed Paquin works to protect Vermonters with disabilities against abuse, neglect, and violation of their rights. And he's a former president of the Vermont Coalition for Disability Rights. Thanks to all three of you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Thank you very much.